Allow me to indulge in a couple of anecdotes as we get our lesson started this morning. One of them comes from a number of years ago at a different congregation where I was not the full-time preacher. But this congregation, good congregation, great people, had a good set of deacons. And one of those deacons, fine man, wonderful kids, had everything on the outside looked like it was going great in his life. He was a song leader and a Bible class teacher and obviously was serving the congregation in a very public capacity. And out of the blue, it was discovered that he'd been having an affair with somebody for quite a while. I don't remember or know exactly how long it was. But he up and left his wife, left his boys, left the congregation, and I believe his parting words with that church were, "I'm just tired of living the way other people want me to live. I'm going to do what I feel like doing." At another congregation, again, a place where I was not a full-time preacher or anything, but at another congregation, someone I knew came forward one Sunday and confessed that he had been dealing with a pornography addiction for quite a long time, and it was time to put it behind him. And good for him putting it behind him and having the courage to come forward and deal with it and tackle a subject that a lot of us just don't feel very comfortable talking about. After the worship service, though, a lady from the congregation was talking about this, this individual who'd come forward with his pornography addiction, and she said, I can't believe it. I just never would have thought, never looking at him, looking at his life and his marriage and everything, I just never would have thought, never could have pictured that somebody like that could have an addiction to pornography. And in both of those stories, notice, if you will, the connection. On the outside, a life that appeared so normal, so healthy, so wholesome, so perfect, but on the inside, depravity. One of the men, of course, didn't want to deal with his depravity in an honest and scriptural manner. The other one did, and give him credit for that. I think that's a wonderful thing. But in both cases, you could look at a person's life and they didn't seem like they had anything wrong with them. They, of all people, really seemed like the last individuals who would have an affair or have an addiction to pornography, to have a sexual sin in their life of any kind, really. And I think that's how it often is with Christians. Today's lesson is going to be fairly hard-hitting. We could talk all day long about the depravity of those who are not saved, of those who do not have a relationship with Jesus Christ, and we can pat ourselves on the back all day long and say, at least we're not as bad as the sinners of the world. But this lesson is going to bring us home. This lesson, we're going to talk about Christians who are dealing with sexual immorality in their lives. We're not going to get real graphic. Don't worry. I know, we've got kids in the audience, and there's questions that they're going to have years down the road that we're just not ready to talk to them about, and that's something you can deal with in your own family. We won't get graphic or anything. We're going to focus mainly on pornography and adultery, because those two, in my experience, those two have been the things most commonly found among Christian men and women, things that they're dealing with in their lives. And there are also things, of all the sins that one might commit, I feel like adultery and pornography are two of the sins that we can keep most secret, even from those we're closest to. And it is that element of secrecy that I think is part of the problem in getting them out in the open and dealing with them and really being honest with them. So with all that introduction being said, let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11. You probably figured I was going to go here eventually, right? A man who on the outside had everything going for him. According to several scriptures, he is a man who was after God's own heart. And yes, we're talking about David. In summing up the story of David and Bathsheba, one writer put it really, really well. He said, "The greatest victories are sometimes annulled by foolish mistakes. David's unparalleled success had made it possible for him to enjoy all the comforts of royal life. No longer did he need to be in the field of combat, since Joab provided capable leadership, and there were no more immediate serious threats to the kingdom. It was in these circumstances that David's greatest failure occurred. It was tragic indeed that such a brilliant career should be marred in this manner. However, it is well known that Satan is most effective in his approaches when the believer is comfortable and successful. That is why I would contend that we should not be so surprised when a deacon, a preacher, an elder, a prominent church member, somebody, man or woman, who has a perfect life on the outside, falls into sexual sin. We shouldn't be so surprised, because that is exactly when, where, and how Satan loves to flourish. He wants to catch us when we're most comfortable. He wants to catch us when we're on top of a pedestal, when we feel safe and secure, when we feel insulated from sin. I'm a preacher, right? I'm a deacon. I'm an elder. I've been going to church for 50 years. I am, of all people, the least one that you should be worried about of falling into some kind of a sin like that. I definitely wouldn't do something like that. I'm not sinner quality. That's exactly when Satan wants to catch us, when we're least prepared for it. And so we start in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 1 with these words. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab. And it goes on to say, so David stayed at Jerusalem. David was always a man of action in his career. That was what typified him. That was what really defined him. Was he always was out there. He was in the wilderness. He was in the fields. He was in battle, in combat. As a young man, he was a shepherd. He would not have been accustomed to the comforts of home life. He was rugged, worthy of his calling. When he was beyond a shepherd, even when he was in Saul's good graces, even then he was out killing his 10,000s. When Saul wanted to kill him because of jealousy, where did David go? Out in the wilderness, living in the cave of Adullam. He traveled around on foot, on horseback, living under trees, sleeping in caves. When he was a king, finally anointed as he should be, and he had the kingdom in his grasp, he fought battles. And that was where he was best. Staying home was not David's forte. And so at a time when other kings were going out to battle, this was the springtime, it was typical for kings to go out to battle, where was David? David was at home. Now, I don't want to jump all over David here. I think that there's another side to this that we need to remember for just a moment. That David was an older man now. He was much more mature. He'd had a lot of years under his belt. And like it's always been said, it's not the years, it's the mileage. And David certainly was a man who had a lot of mileage on his body. So forgive him, if you will, for wanting to spend a little bit of time at home for once in his life. So I think we can see, with reasonable degree, that he had a right to enjoy some comfort. God had blessed him on all sides. He had safety from his enemies. And he wanted to stay home for once. Joab was a good leader. He could send Joab and fight the battles for him. With all that being said, though, if what you are good at is being out in the field of combat, then you need to be out in the field of combat. And I really believe that if David was out in the battlefield where he was most apt, where his skills were best served, the rest of the chapter would not have happened. I mean, you can argue all day long whether he should have been at home or should have been out in the battlefield, but the reality is, if the chapter started with, and in the spring when kings went out to battle and David went out to battle too, the rest of the chapter would not have happened. Plain and simple. And again, that's where Satan wants to catch us. He's not catching us when we're doing God's work. He's not catching us when we're busy being productive with our lives. He catches us when we're at leisure. He catches us when we have nothing that we're supposed to be doing right now. That's how he catches us. He catches us in the middle of the night when there's nothing else to be doing but cruising the internet. He catches us when we're most comfortable, most at leisure, most at rest, with our guard down. And so the text goes on to describe a series of events now. You begin in verse 2. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed. Isn't it interesting that David was a man who could sleep on rocks and in caves and under trees, and it could survive in the wilderness as a shepherd? And yet here he is in the comforts of his own home, sleeping on a king-sized bed, surrounded by luxury. And he's having restless nights. He's up in the middle of the night wandering around because he can't sleep. Because again, when you're a man who is used to action and business and work, you're a hardy individual,
comforts and silk sheets just don't do it for you. So he rose from his bed and walked around the roof of the king's house. And again, if you know anything about the layout of the city of Jerusalem at this point, the king's house would have been near the top of the hill of Zion, around where the temple would have been built during Solomon's time period. And so because his house is near the top of the city, he can basically, from his roof, look down on anybody else. And I don't want you to think I'm saying that he's a voyeur or anything. I don't think that's why he was up there. He didn't wake up in the middle of the night thinking he was going to sneak in and look around in people's windows. He's not being a voyeur here. But that's, again, how temptation works. That's how temptation works. When you have those sleepless nights, you don't get on the internet looking for trouble. You get on the internet going to check Facebook, looking at sports scores. And then you go to ESPN.com, and on the side, the little advertisement on the side grabs your attention. A woman in a bikini selling beer. And that's how it begins. That's how it begins. You don't get up looking for that. You don't get up intending to be a voyeur. But when you're on the top of your roof looking down at everybody else's homes into their windows, is it really going to be any surprise that every now and then there will be something to see? Something that catches your eye. So she caught her eye, his eye. There was Bathsheba. From the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. You all know how the story ends, don't you? If you're not familiar with David's life, what ends up happening is he takes the woman Bathsheba into his own house after inquiring about her. Almost as if she's so beautiful, he just can't help himself. That might have been his rationalization. She's just right there. She's all by herself. What am I supposed to do with a woman like that who's so beautiful in appearance? So he takes her. In the course of the rendezvous, impregnates her. She says those three famous last words, "I am pregnant." What does he do after that? Does he respond with honesty? Does he go find the husband and explain the situation? Beg for forgiveness? Offer him anything? Cower before a man? Who, according to the book of Proverbs, if you remember, in the book of Proverbs, it describes that when you sleep with another man's wife, hey, the guy can be forgiven if he wants to come after you. He'll forgive a man for stealing his stuff. But when you steal a man's wife, he will be enraged. And he'll come after you with everything he has. So what does David do? Bathsheba is Uriah's wife. Uriah the Hittite. You learn later on, near the end of 2 Samuel, that Uriah was one of David's most trusted warriors. He was one of the original 30. One might assume one of the original warriors who came to him at the cave of Adullam. When David was in his hour of need, these men, individuals who were outcasts from society themselves, came to David and surrounded him and protected him. And they were with him through thick and thin, through every single battle, before he was king and after he was king. And Uriah was one of those men. Uriah wasn't just a random stranger. Uriah was a man who David had known for 20 plus years. He fought battles side by side with Uriah the Hittite. Now he gets Uriah drunk. He tries to convince him that he slept with his own wife to impregnate her. That doesn't work. The whole plan backfires because Uriah is so righteous that even when Uriah is made drunk by David, he still won't go in and sleep with his wife. Because he says, as long as Joab and the other Israelites are in the wilderness sleeping in tents, as long as the ark of our God is living in a tent, I'm not going to take this opportunity to go home and sleep in my own bed and enjoy the comforts of life. Next, David has Uriah killed. Because what's the next step? What else can you do? What else are you... What is left to do? Uriah's not the only one who gets killed, by the way. When you read in the text, the battle becomes so heated that a number of Israelites actually get killed in the process. David must have felt some relief then when a messenger came to him after all was said and done and said, oh yes, there were some who were killed in the battle, and Uriah the Hittite was one of them. Whew.
We're glad we've got that resolved, don't we? Now, here's kind of where I came up with the title of this lesson, of how did it come to this? David must have looked at himself in the mirror after all this was said and done. He has lusted, and that lust turned into adultery. The adultery turned into lies and betrayal. The lies and the betrayal turned into a misuse of his power as the head of his army. And that misuse of power led to the deaths of not just one, but multiple soldiers in his army. Israelites. People fighting for his cause. And he must have looked at his hands, symbolically stained in all this blood, and said, how did it come to this? How did I get to this point? I'm a man after God's own heart. Don't we do the same thing? After all is said and done, I have known so many Christians, men and women, who have told me that the act of adultery and the act of looking at pornography, both are the same way. They say, something overcomes me. Something takes me over. I get drawn in, and I do it, and I go overboard. And then when I'm kind of fried, my nerves pop. Something jogs me back into reality, and I go, whoa. What have I done? How did this happen? How did I allow myself to fall so far? It was because of small, progressive steps. Think of it this way. David didn't wake up that morning thinking that he was going to turn out the way he did. He didn't wake up in the middle of the night anticipating that his life was going to become what it became. His downfall, just like ours, came because of a series of small and progressively more severe steps. Hell is going to be filled with people just like this, by the way. Hell is going to be filled with all kinds of people who never understood the severity of each of these steps along the way. I didn't know it would end up like this. I didn't know it would turn out like this. I didn't know it would lead to this. I thought it was so innocent. I thought everybody did it. I didn't think it was such a big deal. There's going to be all kinds of people on the judgment day who feel like they're justified. How did it come to this? Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 5 actually addresses this very issue. Let's go to the Sermon on the Mount. And notice in Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 27, he says here in Matthew 5:27, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. We'll save the next verse there, Jesus' prescription for the problem, for another few minutes here. You know what's interesting here? What started with a mere look of covetousness, or what started with a mere look grew into covetousness here in Matthew chapter 5. And the covetousness paved way for the adultery to happen in a person's heart. Understand something here about this passage, though. Jesus is not equating natural human desire with adultery. And I think sometimes we read it that way. We look at it and say, well, lust is the exact same thing as actually committing the act of adultery. And I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. He's actually using a word here that in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, is the exact same word used in the 10th commandment of you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet his possessions. You shall not covet his livestock. Covetousness is not the same thing as human natural desire. Think of it this way. I think this is a good analogy. I can be in my backyard and I can smell my neighbor's barbecue going on. And I can smell it, and a natural human desire results. There's nothing wrong with that natural human desire. I'm designed, I'm made in such a way that when I smell barbecue, I'm going to go, that makes me want barbecue. But that's not covetousness yet. I go from a natural human desire to sin when I start peering over my neighbor's fence, looking into the yard. When I'm trying to time when his trips indoor, back out, and back in are going to be, and when I'm starting to gauge the height of the fence so that I see if I can jump it, can I get back with a rack of ribs in my arm and get over the fence again? When I'm starting to concoct plans of getting away with my sin, that's when it becomes covetousness. Now, I'll put it this way. recognizing honestly that a person is attractive is not a sin. And again, I think sometimes we maybe have a puritanical approach to it, like, I don't know about that. Recognizing honestly that a person is attractive is not a sin. Just as smelling a barbecue in your neighbor's yard has not become covetousness. And I can see my neighbor buy a new car, and I can say, hey, that's a nice car. That's a cool looking car. And it's still not covetousness. And I might even go home and say, you know, if I put my time in and save my money and do this or that, maybe I can get a cool car like that also. That's still not covetousness. That's a natural human desire. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to personalize it and say, I look at all your wives and think they're all attractive. That's not what I mean, okay? Please, let's kind of keep the decorum here that we need for this conversation. But just again, understand that what Jesus is saying is not that you look at a person and go, wow, she's pretty. That's not lust. Jesus is saying covet here. It's the same Greek word in the Septuagint for coveting in the 10th commandment. It's not a matter of having a natural attraction to the opposite sex or recognizing that a person is handsome or beautiful. But when you set your heart to act upon that, when you set your heart upon taking something that is not yours to have, that's covetousness. Let's go back to the story of David then. David's on his rooftop. That's not sin. Having a sleepless night. That's not sin. We all get insomnia every now and then. He wants a cool breeze in his face, so he goes outside. That's not sin. He's looking down at the beautiful city of Jerusalem, over which he is king. Still, not sin. And by accident, he happens to see a woman bathing in her house. At that point, still not sin. But when he dwells upon the image, when he goes inside and cannot get her out of his mind, when he asks his servants to inquire about who she is, find out who that woman is who lives down in that house. Oh, her name is Bathsheba. Really? When he asks his servants to bring the woman into his own home. Yeah, that's when it becomes sin. That is the problem of sin. And James chapter 1 explains it pretty clearly also. In James chapter 1, beginning in verse 14, I think we're told pretty clearly that it is not lust per se, a natural human attraction that is not the problem. It's when we allow the lust to take over. Notice what he says in verse 14, but each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. When sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. James nowhere condemns lust per se. That is, if we understand lust to be a natural function of physical attraction. The problem is allowing lust to carry us away to dark places when we fail to control it and turn our eyes away. Friends, it starts with the heart. Look at Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12. In Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12, I like the way that the writer of Hebrews puts this. Take care, brethren, he says, lest there should be in any one of you an evil and unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. Where does falling away start? Falling away doesn't necessarily start with the stimulus around you. Obviously, you can't just leave the world. You can't just put blinders on to everything that's out there. Otherwise, you'd have to live in a monastery or something and never look at anything. You have to stare at a brick wall all day long. Falling away starts with the heart, though. A weakening of the will to do what is right. When you begin to have an evil and unbelieving heart, that paves the way for falling away from God. If your heart is weakened, your steps will be weakened also. And yet people will still come along and say, but I'm only human. I'm only human. What do you expect me to do? There's all this stuff out there, stimulation all around me. I go to the beach and it's right there. I go to the pool and it's right there. I go to the grocery store and there's Cosmopolitan sitting right in front of me. I can't go anywhere without seeing something. It's everywhere. I'm only human. What do you expect from me? You expect me to be some kind of Superman or something? You expect me to go live in a monastery on the top of a mountain or in a cabin in the woods where I'll never meet anybody or see anybody or have any stimulation of any kind in that regard? What do you expect?
I'm only human.
And we rationalize all kinds of sins. Married couple whose love life has been neglected. And they say, but I'm only human. I'm a right hot-blooded man. Don't I deserve something also? Well, he doesn't care about me. He doesn't give me the affection, the attention that I once got from him. Don't I deserve to have someone who appreciates me? We rationalize all kinds of things. Well, I'm only human. You know, when I think about this excuse, this actually is rather insulting to me. The statement really becomes an accusation against God and his power to create us in a certain way. When you say, I'm only human, what does Psalm 8 say about being only human? Psalm 8 says that we're made for a little while lower than the angels. Psalm 8 describes us in a very, very exalted manner, that we are created in God's image. And yet we'll say, but I'm only human. Only human? That does not compute. I think God's response would be, you're not only human, you are human. Dogs act upon their instincts without thinking. Animals do what they feel like without any moral compass. The beasts of the field follow their impulses. You are not an animal. You're not only human, you are human. You're the only creature on the face of this planet that has been called to be bigger than the creation itself. You're the only thing on this planet that has been called to be like God in his image, to serve him in glory, to attain to a moral standard that is above instinct and impulse and natural desire. You're not only human, you're human. It's insulting to say, I'm only human. And it's insulting to those who don't give in also. What about the rest of us who have not committed adultery? What about those who do not participate in pornography and the filthy things of the world? Isn't it a bit insulting to say, well, I'm only human, and yet there are people who do overcome it? Don't buy into cheap excuses for the things that you've done. Don't buy into the sorry rationalizations of worldly people who want to make you think that you are less than what God calls you to be and less than what God believes that you can and should be. Feel exalted, not defeated by sin. Now, with the rest of the lesson, we're going to look at just a few warning signs, some things that might be an indicator that you're going down the wrong path, that things are starting to get dicey with you. Remember that David was a man after God's own heart, according to Acts chapter 13, verse 22, quoting from Samuel, which is a warning that even very spiritual and godly men can and do fall away from him. Remember our anecdotes at the beginning of the lesson. These are all Christians we're talking about. I've known deacons, I've known elders, I've even known preachers who've had affairs. I've known preachers who've dealt with pornography addictions for years and years and years. And they end up leaving the ministry because they can't beat their sin. It is people like David who fall into sexual temptation. So never ever fall for the lie that you can somehow be insulated because of your status, because of your experience as a Christian. The first warning sign that I think I would notice is compliments. Watch out for compliments. One woman writes in a book called The Snare, "When I was in a loving marriage relationship, I could not understand what drove believers to immorality. But now that I have spent years alone, I better understand what it means to be famished. What we must recognize is that selling our birthright, our soul, for mere stew, the false intimacy of immorality, is never the answer." Notice Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 7. I think this is exactly what this woman is writing about. Proverbs 27 verse 7 says that a sated man loathes honey. Is a full man, someone who's completely satisfied. He loathes honey. But to a famished man, any bitter thing is sweet.
Now, I'm not saying that somebody in a supposedly perfect marriage isn't also going to be tempted to sin. Even people in an ideal marriage situation are still going to face temptation. But I think oftentimes the temptation comes when we're down. The temptation comes when we're feeling bad about ourselves, feeling bad about our relationships, when there's something unresolved, arguments that we've had, if we feel like we're not appreciated. And it is in that time when we feel famished, hungry for attention and affection and attraction. We want to feel like we're valuable. We want to feel like we're handsome. We want to feel like we're beautiful. And it's in those moments where we are being famished at home that we're willing to take anything from anybody. Any compliment makes us feel better. To a man who is famished, any bitter thing is sweet. It might not be perfect. It might not be ideal, but it's something. I don't think Christians wake up wanting to become porn addicts. And I don't think Christians, for the most part, wake up wanting to have an affair. But the way they think about it is, if I am not satisfied, if I'm not appreciated, if I don't feel affectionate at home, I'll get it from somewhere. And at least something is better than nothing. Anything is better than nothing. We rationalize it by saying, well, here is someone who finally appreciates me. My spouse never compliments me like this anymore. It's been so long since somebody expressed sexual attraction to me. It's this feeling of inadequacy that we feel in the eyes of our spouse that drives us to seek fulfillment in other relationships. Of course, pornography is an easy answer to this desire. It's an easy, quick, cheap answer to this desire. It is something that requires very little from us, except sometimes dollars and your sense of self-dignity and self-worth, and it can be masked with a little bit of effort. Pornographers target people with feelings of inadequacy by saying all the right things and appealing to both the emotions and the physical desires of those who are ensnared. That's how it works. That's how it operates. Watch out for compliments. Watch out for the person at work who's always complimenting you. Watch out for yourself when you are craving people's attention. The prolonged stare, the lingering touch. Proverbs 6, verse 25 says, "Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids." It's that stare. When you notice a person staring at you, and you kind of think, like, I'm in the restaurant here, I'm walking down the sidewalk, and that, she notices me. She likes what she sees. Hey, some women like them a little thinner, okay? But it's that prolonged stare, and then you stare back. But I think that's what happened to David. And again, I would not contend at all that it was sin when David first noticed Bathsheba. If it's a situation that you can't help and you're feeling natural human attraction, but it's when you linger, when you stare, when the image stays in your mind longer than it really should. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 30 is Jesus' prescription for it. If your right eye causes you to stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. That's how seriously Jesus takes it. That's how seriously he takes the images that enter our minds through our eyes. Remember what Jesus said about it. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If the eye is clear, you'll see clearly. If the eye has obstruction in it, then everything else that comes through it is going to be filtered through that obstruction of sorts. I know it's easy to say and very hard to do, but we must resist the urge to stare when the temptation presents itself. And let me explain, I think, my practical solution, because you're wondering, yeah, sure, that's easy to say. If you're not addicted to pornography, it's easy to say, well, stop looking. That's not so easy to do, though. It's not so easy to do. Here's my practical advice. Be very intentional, even with the small stuff. Be very obvious and intentional that you're turning your eyes away. And build on one little victory to another victory, to another victory and another victory. I know very few people who've been able to quit something cold turkey.
Well, I know some who have, but I think probably one way that might work is to just find some victory somewhere. Turn your eyes away from the magazines at the grocery store. Start there. I mean, just at the very least, just start there. Turn your eyes away and make it obvious. Don't look at the magazines at the grocery store. Make it obvious. You know, and when you've done that, you say, you know, that is one small victory that I can build on. It goes from that to maybe just don't go to the pool. You know, we say, well, there's stuff at the pool all the time. Well, maybe don't go to the pool. Let that be another small victory for you, okay? Take those little victories, those little moments where you are obvious and intentional and say, right now, I can't promise tomorrow. I can't predict what's going to happen in the future. But right now, in this moment, I am intentionally going to turn my eyes away from that temptation. As small as it might be, as innocent as it seems, this moment, I am going to beat that temptation. And we'll let tomorrow deal with itself. Remember, Jesus said that in the Sermon on the Mount also. Don't worry about the problems of tomorrow. Tomorrow has enough worries all its own. You need to worry about right now. You need to worry about what is in front of you right now, the anxieties, the stresses, the problems, and the temptations. Fix the things right now. Make a vow this day. I think you're going to face failure if you stretch it too far, because I've known enough Christians when I've counseled them about pornography addiction. I've known enough Christians who said, I'll make these big, bold moves. Like, I am never going to look ever again. That's good in theory. I think a better vow to make would be today. I'm not going to worry about tomorrow. Today, I am not going to look. I can't make promises about the future. But today, I am not going to look. Just beat today. Start with that. Work your way up from there. And the last point that we'll make this morning. Stop being naive about your spouse. Sadly, many marriages become very boring, functional, utilitarian. Marriage is about raising kids together. Marriage is about making sure that we get our mortgage paid on time. Marriage just becomes boring and functional. And when a marriage becomes boring and functional, what happens is that we get used to our spouse. We lose the electricity. You know, anyone who's married understands it. You see your spouse in every light. The bright light and the very dim light as well. Okay, when you live with a person, you know everything. And you start seeing them in a very honest way. I think we have this assumption then that the rest of the world sees our spouse maybe the same way we do, as a flawed, imperfect person who gets sick, who has strange habits, picks her teeth, you know. We have, and Rebecca doesn't pick her teeth, by the way. But I think we assume that the rest of the world sees our spouse the way we do. We forget that the rest of the world still sees our spouse with a facade. They still see our spouse as an unknown commodity. And we don't realize that there might be somebody out there who thinks our spouse is very, very attractive. You might not find your spouse as attractive as you did when you first knew each other, when you first were married. You might not have the same electricity, but guess what? Other people still do see our spouses the same way. Just because you've seen your spouse in every light doesn't mean everybody else has. And I think we need to stop being naive about our spouses. We need to fight for our spouses a little bit more. Don't forget that there's a world of predators out there who see your spouse, your teenage children, as potential meals. Don't allow your spouse to be victimized, but be proactive about things. Be engaging. Essentially, never stop fighting for your spouse's love. Because there are other people out there who are fighting for her love. Fighting for his love. There are other people out there who are vying for his or her attention. Who are trying to steal him away by the look in the eyes. There are people out there who are preying upon him. Who are preying upon her. You've got to be the defender of your spouse. Fight back with as much force as you need to. fight away those who are coming to take his or her affections away from where they ought to be. You are fighting a $10 billion a year industry in pornography. You think about that? Most estimates are between $5 and $15 billion a year industry. Let's just average. How many other industries are there out there that are $10 billion a year? You are your spouse's only spouse. One person, one man, one woman fighting the temptations of a $10 billion industry that has been doing its thing almost from the very beginning of time. Talk about a David and Goliath story, huh? Talk about the odds being stacked against you. And when you think of it that way, I think that should really motivate us to realize we are up against some massive, massive odds in keeping our marriages pure. These are seemingly insurmountable challenges. But I think that the thing we should recall is that real, meaningful affection, true intimacy, emotional honesty, and the rewards of that kind of life will always, always beat out the purveyors of pointless, meaningless, soul-draining sex if the people involved in that marriage are willing to be committed to it for life. Remember Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, and we'll go ahead and end with that verse. In Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, he says, "Enjoy life with your wife all the days of your fleeting life." You notice he says all the days. Not just when you're young and handsome and thin. We all look at our wedding photos. Oh, what happened? What happened to the brown hair? We all look at it. But he says, enjoy life with your spouse all the days of your fleeting life. In the same way that you might make a vow that says, today I will not look at pornography. Today I will not give in to the advances of a tempter. Maybe you should make a vow also every single day that says, today I'm going to enjoy life with my spouse. Whether we have a lot of money or a little money, whether we're young or old, healthy or sick, today I'm going to make the most out of my life with my spouse. Never stop seeing him or her as your reward. Because the world is out there offering all kinds of treasures. The world is out there offering you all kinds of shiny things. When you look at your spouse, you look at your spouse and all the honesty that you share with each other, your pain, the suffering, your anguish when you fight. You look at your spouse. Never stop seeing him or her as your reward in this life. Now, if you have given in to sexual temptation at some point, especially if it has been recent, I want to give you a suggestion. I know typically we'd ask you to come forward as we stand and sing, but I think there's more that needs to be done for you. If you're facing a pornography addiction, adultery, fornication, whatever it happens to be, I won't encourage you necessarily to come forward as we stand and sing. I would encourage you to talk to me. Let me counsel you. Let me help you work through these things. Find me discreetly, and we'll talk about these things in private, okay? If there is a need, though, that needs to be addressed this day, then please don't hesitate to make that need known while together we stand and sing.